This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Many first-time novelists pray for the luck that David Benioff had. The movie rights to his first novel, 25th Hour, were purchased by Tobey Maguire before the novel was even published. Benioff got to write the screenplay. Spike Lee directed it, Edward Norton stars in it, and now it's out on video. 25th Hour is about a young drug dealer named Monty, who has one day left before beginning his 7-year prison sentence at Otisville Federal Penitentiary in New York. In those 24 hours, he wants to tie up the loose ends of his life and find out who betrayed him to the police. In this scene from the film, Monty, played by Norton, is having dinner with his father, who owns a bar that was paid for with Monty's drug money. The father's played by Brian Cox.
I don't want you to get involved, okay? I mean it. I'm going to be all right.
You know, you'll still be a young man when you get out. I know you don't think about it, but don't start any trouble in there. Keep your head down.
Don't worry about me, please.
This should never have happened.
You could have been, if you wanted money, you could have done anything you wanted. Doctor, lawyer.
Don't lay that on me.
That's all I'm saying.
Don't lay that on me. I mean, when Sal and his crew were squeezing you for the payments, I didn't hear you wishing I was a law school student then. Not one from you back then. Where'd you think that money was coming from? Donald Trump?
That was a mistake.
Well, let's just forget it then.
There were lots of mistakes. I should have stopped drinking when your mother passed.
Oh, please. Please don't do this.
11-year-old boy with a dead mother and a drunk father. Oh, you know, I got no one to blame but myself.
Oh, stop. Stop. It wasn't you, Bob.
A scene from the film 25th Hour. When Terry spoke with David Benioff this winter, she asked him to read a passage from the same scene as it appears in the novel.
"This should never have happened," says Mr. Brogan, staring at his glass of soda water. "All right, let's not start now. It's a little late in the game." "I know," says Mr. Brogan. "I know it, and I'm sorry, Monty. I should never have let you get involved." Monty raps the tabletop with his knuckles. "Hey, let it go. You had nothing to do with it, okay? Don't start with this now." "I just wish we could have talked about it. You could have made so much money in a real business. You didn't need that. You should never have got involved with that." But money was never the sole draw for Monty. He hadn't grown up poor, and he wasn't greedy. He liked fast cars and Italian shoes, but he didn't need them, didn't hunger for them. It was more about sway. Sway helps make your money, and money helps make your sway, but sway is not money. Sway is walking into a clothes shop and knowing you can buy anything on the shelves, true. But sway is also the clerk opening the shop after hours, so you can walk through the aisles alone with your girlfriend. Sway is the clerk unlocking the back room to show you the latest deliveries, still sheathed in plastic bags. Sway is the clerk standing silent in the corner while you browse, and the clerk won't complain if you paw the merchandise and kiss your girl for an hour because he knows about you and the trouble's not worth it.
That's David Benioff reading from his novel 25th Hour, which he adapted into a screenplay for the movie of the same name. David, how did you first get the idea for this story of, you know, the guy who has 24 hours before he goes to prison for 7 years?
I went to a party for a guy who was going to prison the next day, and not someone I knew particularly well, but it was a very unusual scene. And at that time, I'd always kind of assumed that once you got convicted of a crime, you're let off from the courtroom in shackles and all. And so I didn't realize there was, for so many convicts, this kind of limbo period between sentencing and actual beginning of incarceration. And this party was such a surreal atmosphere. And there was, you know, a printout banner on the wall saying, "Do not drop the soap." And people were drinking and, you know, seemed to be having fun and all. But I couldn't help but stare at this guy who was going in the next day and think, you know, what's going through his mind right now? I mean, how can he even be pretending to have a good time? And that just stuck in my head for years. And eventually I had written two novels before and both had been rejected. And I was looking for a new idea for a story. And this is what I came up with.
So what are the main things that you have put in your character's mind as he faces that last day of freedom?
A whole bunch of things. I mean, anything from, you know, self-loathing and self-pity to this kind of sense of just an immediate nostalgia. I mean, he's wandering through New York on his last night out, and he knows this is a kid who's grown up in New York City, who's never really left it for any length of time. And, you know, he's saying his goodbyes to all his friends and his father and the woman he loves, but one of the main characters he's saying goodbye to is New York, and he's trying to retain as many images of the city as possible because he knows he's going to be trapped in a cell for 7 years, and he wants those mental snapshots to hold on to.
Now, in the movie version of 25th Hour, the New York that the character is saying goodbye to is the post-September 11th New York.
Right.
It's the Manhattan that still has the shrines to the people who died on September 11th. The opening credits actually has that double-beamed sculpture that briefly commemorated those people who lost their lives on September 11th and commemorated the World Trade Center towers. Was that a difficult decision, whether to like find a way to work that in, since you were shooting after September 11th, or whether you should kind of pretend it didn't happen and just do it as written?
It wasn't that difficult, actually. And speaking to Spike Lee about it, he's extremely passionate about the idea that if you're going to film a movie in New York in the year after 9/11, after the attack, it would be dishonest to pretend that it hadn't happened. And he speaks, you know, I think very, very eloquently about his, you know, so many directors have chosen to digitally remove the Twin Towers from shots of New York and so forth, and Spike didn't want to do that. I mean, it's a very much a New York story. And, I mean, oddly enough, there are elements in the book, you know, which was written well before the attack. You know, for instance, Monty's obsessed with firemen. And so it made sense that there would be some reference to it. And it's clearly not a story about 9/11, but it is a story about New York in the year after. And we thought that it would be dishonest to not confront that issue and the way it's affected people.
One of the things I really like about your novel and the screenplay is that I think you write terrific dialogue. Did you have to make a lot of changes in adapting the dialogue from the novel into dialogue for the film, knowing that people actually had to speak the dialogue in the movie?
A lot of the dialogue I was able to take pretty closely from the book. I mean, there are certain places that ended up getting cut. For example, there's a long monologue where Monty asks Jacob, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman in the movie, he asks Jacob to take his dog, and it's probably the longest speech that Monty has in the book, and it was certainly the longest speech in the screenplay, and a very important speech for me. And we ended up having to cut it because we just didn't really have time for it. And, you know, something that a page in a book can work fine, but listening to a character speak for a minute and a half on screen can sometimes be dull. So, yeah, you know, there were times where we had to make alterations like that.
Did Spike Lee or the actors give you any feedback on the dialogue? And were there any lines that look great on the page, but you realized once an actor was going to be speaking it, that it was a little too writerly?
Yeah. I mean, the first time I went to visit set, actually, it's kind of an odd thing for the writer to go to set because there's not much for you to do on set. And everyone's very nice to you and all, but you kind of feel like you're just in the way because you can't even move equipment or anything. You're just sort of off to the side. And they gave me some headphones. So I was listening to the actors speaking. And in one of the scenes, 30 seconds after I put on the headphones, I heard one of the actors saying, I can't read this line. It's stiff. This dialogue is stiff. You know, it was kind of just a knife to the gut when I heard that. So that was, I think I threw off the headphones and kind of slunk away. There are definitely some places where it works in my head, you know, when I hear the characters saying it, it works in my head. But then when you hear the actual actor speaking the lines, it doesn't quite work. And, you know, we were lucky enough that we had very, very talented actors. And, you know, there are certain places where they were just ad-libbing. And there are certain places where Spike Lee came up with the line that he thought would work better. And, you know, which can be painful at times for the writer, but it's also just recognizing that this is a collaborative process and that, you know, having faith in the other people on set to do their jobs.
In 25th Hour, there's a couple of key scenes that take place in a club that's owned by drug dealers. And, you know, some of the people inside the club are part of that scene, and other people inside the club are just trying to make the scene and be in the right place, and they're clueless to what else is happening in the club. You were once a bouncer for a club, is that right?
Yeah, in San Francisco.
So was it the kind of club that was backed by drug money?
Well, the owner of the club had spent time in prison for drug offenses, and yeah, you know, I never really asked too many questions about where the money was coming from. But
that was probably smart.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's kind of this unknown world for a lot of people outside the business. But I mean, the whole The whole idea of a one-way door where the bouncers know exactly who the dealers are and they're letting in certain people, they're letting in certain dealers and keeping others out to keep the competition away from the dealers, and then the dealers give them a cutback of whatever they make that night.
Is that the position you were in?
No, I never. I was a very junior bouncer, so I was, you know, maybe like the sixth man down the totem pole, and never actually, luckily, I guess, never was getting money from the dealers. Although, you know, I'd get money from other bouncers at the end of a night, and I'm sure they were getting it from them. So indirectly, I probably was, but was never, you know, never actually getting paid off by the local dealer.
So were you the kind of bouncer who decided, who had a good enough leather jacket to get in, or who had a nice enough hairdo, cool enough clothes to get in?
No, see, I wasn't even that senior. I was more the bouncer in the back near the dance floor who was watching, you know, and seeing when the drunks started getting too rowdy and trying to break up fights whenever possible. And I was also probably the most peaceful bouncer in the history of bouncing, and I would always try to, I found that giving someone a free cocktail, which is probably, you know, thinking back on it, not the best thing to give to a rowdy drunk person, but would almost always break up a fight before it happened. And so, you know,
how would you do that? Two people are fighting, you go, hey, want a free
drink?
Well,
not once actual fisticuffs has started, it's impossible. Then you just have to get them out of there. But when you see, I mean, you hang out in these clubs long enough, and plus, you know, the fact that you're sober as the bouncer and everyone else in there is not, you can kind of see things starting to happen, and you can feel the tension level rising. And so just trying to step in before blows have actually been exchanged and, you know, take someone aside and try to make it, you know, a question of, you know, try to just deflate the person's temper as much as possible. And I remember saying, I remember when this absolutely enormous bodybuilder and his brother, two enormous guys, were about to murder this guy. And I walked in and I knew that if something happened, I mean, I didn't have any, you know, backup there, and I wasn't going to be able to really defend myself from these guys. And I just kind of in desperation, I said, you know, listen, you guys, I wouldn't walk into your house and disrespect your house. You guys are in my house right now, and I think you should respect that and let me buy you a drink. And it was kind of just, you know, a Hail Mary. And for some reason, they responded to it. And I said, you know, okay. And I got them drinks and got the other guy out of there. And nothing happened.
You're in a studio in L.A. and I'm in a studio in Philadelphia. How big are you?
I am 6'2". And at the time when I was bouncing, I was 210. And now I've lost a lot of weight. I'm probably about 190 now. So that was back when I was playing rugby and wrestling and all, and was much thicker.
Does this help you command respect at story meetings?
it's definitely you don't get as intimidated in story meetings once you've faced down two angry Samoans.
Being a bouncer is, in a way, a good occupation for a fledgling novelist, because what you're doing is observing people and making judgments about their character.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I think being a bouncer and then later being a high school teacher were both very helpful jobs in terms of observing characters and, you know, observing characters in stress, particularly.
Who challenged you more, your students or the guys in the club?
Definitely the students. I mean, I taught in Brooklyn, which was a lot of fun. Also, you know, sometimes frustrating. It's interesting because I also taught college at Irvine, where everyone was very well-behaved and disciplined. And while I was teaching in Brooklyn, I think I would have thought that was my, you know, my dream to have a well-behaved class. And it turned out it was actually much less interesting, because the kids in Brooklyn, as rowdy as they were, you know, first of all, just getting great dialogue from them. I mean, I think it's one of the great things about being a teacher as a writer is you just hear the way kids speak and you hear the new jargon. And so phrases that I used in the book that I never would have heard, I think, if I hadn't been hanging around with 16-year-olds. And
can you think of a particular phrase that stuck in your mind that you used?
You know, I remember one of the first classes I taught, this kid named Angel wrote a poem about getting lifted, and he was finished reading, and it's a really good poem. And I said, just tell me, what does it mean to get lifted? And everyone's kind of laughing and all. I said, no, tell me, what does it mean? And he said, oh, it means getting high. And I thought, lifted, to get lifted, that's a nice way of saying it. And since then, I've heard it in, you know, in rap songs and all, but I hadn't, at that time, hadn't been exposed to it.
Do you miss, in a way, having a connection to that? One of the things I think one of the frustrations that scriptwriters, successful screenwriters, have is that they can sometimes be cut off from real life.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely that danger. I work at home, and it's kind of isolated. I mean, one of the nice things is that out here in Los Angeles, I have one of my best writing students when I was teaching in Brooklyn, went on. He's now actually at the graduate school at USC, master's program writing screenplays, and I see him a lot, and he's writing and doing wonderful stuff and very talented young writer. So that's been one very gratifying moment as an ex-teacher to see that. But yeah, I try to get out when I can, but there's also, I think, you know, a lot of writers have a monastic side where you just like to shut the door and just, it's just you and your dog in there and trying to get as much work done as possible.
In the opening scene of the movie and the novel 25th Hour, the main character, the drug dealer, finds an abandoned dog in a deserted part of town. And the dog is lying there all kind of bleeding and cut open. And the main character picks him up and puts him in the trunk of his car to take him to a vet. And the dog is really angry and acting kind of vicious and even bites the main character in his neck. But then, you know, he survives, the dog survives, and becomes the dog of this character, and they're really close.
Right.
And I thought, this writer, here is a man who likes animals.
Well, people have asked me, actually, which characters in the book, you know, who are they based on real people? And really the answer is no, with the exception of the dog. And my old roommate here in Los Angeles was driving in a pretty bad neighborhood one time and saw this black pit bull lying on the side of the road, and she pulled over, and like the dog in the book, this dog had been beaten by its old masters, and cigarettes had been put out on its hide, and so forth. And she, which I've always thought was an incredibly courageous act, she got the dog into her car somehow, despite the fact that this dog did not want any help and was biting at her, and she brought it to the vet and got it patched up, and then she brought it home, and I ended up living with that dog for 2 years. And so, you know, there are times where you get inspiration for ideas from different places, and sometimes you don't know exactly where it comes from. And I think sometimes, that inspiration just wakes you up with its barking in the middle of the night. And I remember thinking, hearing Olive barking, that's an interesting story. That would be an interesting way to get access to a character and to open up a larger story.
Yeah, what do you think it says about your character that he takes the dog?
About Monty's character?
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, later in the long speech where he's talking to, which is not in the movie, but in the book, where he's talking to Jacob and asking Jacob to take the dog, he says it's the best thing he ever did. You know, and the best thing he ever did was save that dog, because every time he hears the dog barking, every time the dog is chasing a ball or chewing a bone, he knows it's because of him. It's because Monty saved the dog's life. And so, you know, it's if nothing else, I mean, Monty has loyalty, you know, and it's a very important part of his code that you have loyalty to those that have done you right. And Doyle, the dog in the book and the movie, you know, is definitely exemplifies that attribute. You know, he's been rescued and he had a new life given to him, and he will never abandon the man who gave him that new life.
Well, David Benioff, I wish you good luck with all the new screenplays that you're writing.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a lot of fun.
David Benioff is the author of the novel 25th Hour. He also wrote the screenplay for the film, now out on video and DVD. Today's the birthday of clarinetist and band leader Benny Goodman. Let's listen to the Benny Goodman Orchestra in 1939 with Lester Young on tenor sax and Lionel Hampton on drums. This is Estrelita. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.